What happens when we face difficult conversations? These conversations can heal. They can foster forgiveness. They can inspire and change perspective. Lean into these stories and discussions. I think both our guests and our listeners will find value in them. And selfishly, I know I will too. If we think long enough, I bet we all can think of an individual who has had an impact on our lives simply because of the kind of person they are. And we can also probably think of an individual or two who has impacted us because of the story that they tell. Much more unusual, though, is an individual who is so memorable, one, because of the kind of person they are, but also because of their story. For me, that person is Mia Welch. And for as long as I've known her, I am always amazed that she is as remarkable a person as the story that she has to tell. And her story is unlike anything I've ever heard before. So today on Lean In, we have a special guest. Her name is Mia Welch, and I've known her since, I think, 2011, when I was doing my residency at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. And we have kept in touch for a couple of reasons. One, she had such a compelling story. And on top of that, she was just one of those people that you just don't forget when you get to know her. So we've kept in touch for 10 years, and I really think her story is worth telling. And so I'm really happy that she was willing to come on Lean In and tell us her story. So, Mia, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, of course.
So I just want to kind of go back to before I met you. So like in 2010, what was going on in your life? Just what were you up to in 2010?
In 2010, I was going to college. I was a dance major. So the majority of my classes I was taking was strictly dance, hanging out with friends, with family. I mean, really just living a relatively normal college life.
And how old were you then? And were you healthy? I mean, did you have any health problems or anything at that point?
No, I've never had any health problems, any health scares. I mean, I've always been extremely active. I've always been able to be extremely active. I've always been healthy. Yeah.
And unfortunately, that changed and you had some pretty significant health issues down the road. But before you realized anything serious was going on, how did it all start?
It started kind of slowly and then just took off. My symptoms came on full force about maybe 3 months after one of my first symptoms, which was just a lot of pain when I was breathing. And it was more like I couldn't catch a breath, but it kind of felt like I was having muscle spasms. I would go see like the trainer for our dance company, and they all thought it was just muscular, gave me some stretches to do, iced me up, and kind of went from there.
About how long did that go on before you started to really worry about it?
Probably in around May, and I was finally diagnosed in September.
So was it really not until September that you really knew that something serious was going on?
Yeah, it just kept getting worse. And then around like August, I got a lot of like flu-like symptoms. I mean, really just flu symptoms. And that's what I thought I had. I was coughing. I was like just congested, really short of breath. It all kind of went together in my head. And then it just got to a point where
turns out that this really was a life or death situation. When did you actually get the diagnosis, and tell us what that diagnosis ended up being?
I went to a hospital and was admitted for pain and fatigue. This was finally a hospital that kind of took my case a little bit more seriously because my heart rate was like at resting, like 150. They wouldn't let me leave mainly because of that reason. Even with having no pain after pain medication, it was still just extremely high. I was there for about a week and they ran every single test that I could think of, like x-rays and echoes. I had a CAT scan. And mind you, this was the first time I had any medical stuff like this done before. So it was a week in there, but it felt like a lot longer. And I remember the doctor coming in my room. I was by myself waiting for my mom to get there. And he told me that I was in heart failure, congestive heart failure, and it was caused by dilated cardiomyopathy.
Well, I can only imagine what that was like to hear. Do you remember what it was like when you got that news?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't really think that a 20-year-old could be in heart failure. I mean, all my life, you know, before this point, I've heard of it, but I did think it was mostly an elderly people or, you know, people kind of born with heart issues. I didn't know that just a normal, healthy person could go into heart failure. So when they told me that, I mean, when someone tells you your heart is failing, it was just a whole shock. I immediately started crying. I called my mom immediately and she was about 15 minutes away. I think hearing her reaction is what made it like really real for me. My mom was a nurse for 23 years and she couldn't believe it. It just really sunk in that it was really something serious, hearing the tone of my mom's voice and the doctor coming into the room. I mean, I remember it so clearly, like it's giving me goosebumps right now.
Initially, at least, they thought that this was due to a viral illness. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They thought it was viral cardiomyopathy, which basically a virus enters your body. They thought that it attacked my heart and then was said that basically my immune system was trying to attack the virus and kind of killed the rest of the function of my heart. And that's what I thought my diagnosis was up until about 4 years ago. I thought it was viral. So I was discharged. I started a ton of new medications. I had to completely change my diet around. I wasn't allowed to dance anymore from this point. My doctors, you know, they asked me to stop until I had improvement of my heart muscle. When I first did go in, and one of the first cardiologists I was talking to, they did have high hopes that medication would reverse the heart failure. So I did do medication for a year, and my ejection fracture was, when I was first diagnosed, was about 15%. And I think it went up to 25%, and then back down to 15%. And that's when we realized the medication wasn't working. It was kind of just supporting me a little bit, but it wouldn't increase it. It wasn't going to change.
And a normal EF, as we call it, is about 55%. So if we see someone with an EF of 15%, it's concerning. So at this point, they knew that the medication wasn't working. What did they tell you the options were?
Well, they wanted to put a defibrillator in just in case I was having irregular heartbeats. So they did do that. And then after that, I was given the option to be transferred to Mayo Clinic for my care or one other hospital in Arizona. I think it was in Tucson. And my doctor said it was to be evaluated for a heart transplant. And again, I don't think I was I don't know if anyone's really mentally prepared to hear that, but it was really hard to hear and kind of just like shocking, like the word transplant, you know.
Myself, I had heart surgery and heart issues as a baby, but even with that, I can't imagine what it would be like to be told that you need a heart transplant, that your heart is no good anymore. How did you come to terms with that? If you can even come to terms with something like that.
Honestly, I think I was in denial for a big part of it. Like, you know, I kind of made myself try to feel better, tried to do like more walking. And I mean, I was so sick, but I was pushing myself so incredibly hard just to see if I could make myself better. And it was just, I mean, it was heartbreaking. I was I was terrified. I was terrified and I was angry. So this was in October of 2011. I was having multiple tests run at Mayo Clinic, and this is part of the evaluation part of transplant. I mean, there's tons of tests, you know, before you can even get close to being listed. One of the last tests that they did was a right heart cath to check my pressures of my heart. And the doctor who did it, he said if it was under a certain percentage that they would admit me. And it was so quickly once they, you know, got in and started seeing the pressures of my heart, he told me that I was going to be admitted and that we were going to get through this. I was admitted that day, and 2 weeks later, I think my ejection fracture was under 5%. I was on different medications, different drips to try to keep that heart function up, but it was just getting far too bad. So I was fitted for an artificial heart. And on October 31st, I went into emergency surgery for an artificial heart.
Did you even know that there was such a thing as an artificial heart?
No, absolutely not. They came in my room because we were talking about different options. And, you know, at this point, I was 21 years old. I mean, I was an adult. So I signed the papers. I was old enough. So I remember them coming in and showing me the artificial heart and showing me like different types of bridge to transplant support. I asked them to leave the room because I didn't know what they were. I mean, it looked like I was looking at like parts that go underneath your sink. I'm just like, I can't even deal with this. I don't want it. I don't need it. And so at this point, I'm in denial, trying to do laps around the hospital. It just, I didn't know that they could do anything like what they did for me. I had no idea that it was even possible to have an artificial heart.
So what's the actual procedure like, just in the gist of it?
They go in through your chest wall, just like the transplant would take place, and they remove your original heart, and it pushes pneumatic air through, so it works, you know, a lot like a heart to keep everything pushing and moving, but it is a pretty big device. And that's the main thing they were worried about with me, because at this time I was just so small from being sick. But yeah, it was, I think, a 12-hour surgery to get everything in. I had drive lines that came out from underneath my rib cage. And it was basically like I was connected to like a giant washer machine. It was like about that size.
And so when you are hooked up to this, I mean, it's not easy to get up and move around, right?
No, I needed help to go wherever I needed to go. Like, they did have pretty long tubing. So if it was able to be pushed a couple feet, I was able to like get up and go to the bathroom. But I mean, it was like 450 pounds. Like, it wasn't a light machine or anything. It was big. Big Blue, I think that's where it got its name from.
So how long did you have this type of artificial heart?
I want to say I had that one for about a month. And then I was switched out from one device to a different device.
Yeah. And I was still an intern, resident in internal medicine. And I had met you a couple of times, I think, during a couple of different admissions. And everybody in the hospital talked about this girl who has this huge total artificial heart. I mean, it was the size of a refrigerator, like a deep freezer.
And it was loud. Do you remember how loud?
I do. And my question is, like, what did it feel like to have this machine, like literally, what did it feel like to have this machine pumping blood through you?
I mean, it definitely made me bounce, like, because it's so strong. But I remember like the first 2 weeks I had it was miserable because the headaches from it. I mean, it's pushing really, really hard. You could see like my chest jumping. My head was just throbbing. I mean, it was really something that I didn't think that I was ever going to get used to, honestly. Like, it was just very loud. And from the inside, it was like I was jumping. Like, I don't know how to explain it. It was just very strange.
At some point, transition to a device that to me is even more amazing. Tell us about it.
So from Big Blue, I went to the Freedom Driver, which is the same exact They didn't need to like reopen me or anything. They just used the drive lines that were coming underneath my rib cage and connected it to one that is small enough to fit into a backpack. So I think it was about 14 pounds. The reason they don't start people on this one is there's like, you know, a lot of restrictions. It only can pump a certain amount of, you know, it's based off of weight and your blood pressure and a couple different things. So basically they just disconnect you from one thing and very, very quickly connect you to the other one. I mean, like seconds. I was awake when they did it. They did it so quickly. And then I was just able to put my backpack on and I was able to walk. I didn't need anyone. I didn't need a whole entourage around me walking. My heart was literally in my backpack.
And I remember when, I assume once you're a dancer, you're always a dancer, right? So you are still a dancer. And I remember when you got your backpack and you were able to dance again. It was really something special. And I also remember spending some time in some of the courtyards outside. You know, I was an intern, probably overworked and needed to get fresh air. And I'd see you walking around looking at the flowers with your heart in your backpack. It is unbelievable. And this is going to sound like probably a stupid question, but like, how is it powered?
Well, there's extra battery packs that you do charge. When I was in bed, it was plugged into the wall to be charged. So there are battery packs in it. And I think when it's not plugged in, the battery could last like 3 to 6 hours. So you always need to have like something nearby that you can plug into, or it's not good if it dies.
I mean, if it dies, your heart stops, right?
Yeah.
Was that scary to know that, hey, my heart is relying on a battery?
Extremely. And kind of one of the main reasons I decided to stay in the hospital while I waited for my heart because of that. It was just me and my mom living together at the time. And I just felt like it would have brought so much stress to have that kind of hanging over our head and her head. If something did happen, she would have to be the one to try to replace the backpack or swap it. They give you like a different one. If one does die or malfunctions, you have a certain amount of minutes to get the other one plugged in before it's too late. And I felt much more comfortable being in the hospital around my nurses and my doctors and my surgeons, just in case something like that did happen.
How long were you in the hospital?
I was admitted into the hospital October 13th of 2011, and I got my heart March 18th of 2012.
Wow. Was that 5 months almost?
Yeah.
Wow. I remember the room you had. I literally remember exactly where it was. It was like like a college girl's dorm room. Posters everywhere. It smelled like a girl. I mean, it was like you were in college, but you made the most of your situation. And I think that's why everyone was pulling for you. So what was like when you got the call saying that there was a heart ready for you?
Well, I actually got, that was my third call that I got, was my actual transplant. I did have 2 dry runs, which they called and thought maybe there was a possible heart for me. They just didn't work out. But when I got my actual call for my heart, it was on St. Patrick's Day. March 17th was the day I actually got the call. I just didn't go into surgery until, you know, towards the AM of the next day. And I was shocked. I kept telling myself, like, you know, don't get too excited just in case a dry run does happen again, because that's hard to get like ready and mentally start preparing yourself for something. And then, you know, you're not going down into surgery. And it didn't work out that way. All of my family showed up. So we all kind of still were just preparing me to go down. You have to stop eating. You have to no more drinking. And it's kind of a slow process. But I just remember thinking of my donor's family, because I could never just imagining their pain on that day is just heartbreaking. But I also remember not being afraid. I wasn't afraid to go into surgery, which I thought I would be, you know, if it's scary if you think about it, you know, I really didn't know if I was going to come back, because you don't know until you wake up and you're and you're there. The doctors, it's not a promise that you'll wake up from it, that it will take. I wasn't afraid. And I think that was huge.
You've been through so much. I wonder how much that contributed to you being as strong and brave as you were. And then the perspective that you had about thinking of the donor's family, it's, I think, important to touch on, because there's not many situations where we are placed that someone has to die for us to live.
Right.
And that's literally the situation someone is in if they're waiting for a heart transplant.
Exactly. See, there's no living donor, or even though I get asked that question a lot. But they're like, have you ever met your donor? Did you get to meet him? No, I didn't.
But you did actually get contacted by his family, correct?
I did. And we still are in contact. Yes.
What's that like?
At first, it was overwhelming, only because I wasn't sure if this family was actually my heart's family, and I didn't want to give false hope to anybody. And then it was just like amazing. They've been so amazing and kind and understanding. They told me that them meeting me has helped them heal so much. And my donors, he had other organs that went and saved other lives, but they just said they had a really big connection with the heart and really wanted to meet his heart recipient. And they've just been very gentle. They're very caring. You know, they'll check up on me, but they make sure to give me my space. And they, you know, it's always been very, very comfortable.
A lot of people don't realize that when you have an organ transplant, almost any organ transplant, that means you're going to be on certain medications for the rest of your life.
Right.
Tell us about that.
I'm on anti-rejection medicine along with some other meds, but my main ones are my anti-rejection medication, and those are my lifelong meds. And, you know, at first, when I started this 9 years ago with my heart, it was rough. The medicines have some crazy effects at first while your body is getting used to it, tremors and, you know, just making you nauseous sometimes. But I've always had really good levels. I think I've been very, very lucky to not have any sort of issues with my medication. So it's been good. My meds have been very good to me. They haven't been hurting any other organs or anything. It's just routine now. It's just like I have an eternal alarm too that tells me when I need to take my medicine. It's twice a day, every day, forever. And it sounds crazy when I say it out loud, but I think it's just, I've gotten so used to it. It just doesn't even seem like I take pills every day. I do, but it's just become a routine.
At some point, I imagine that thought of being plugged into that artificial heart maybe fades, but probably doesn't totally leave you. I imagine the thought of having someone else's heart inside of you probably fades, but also probably never totally leaves you. And I imagine the thought of having to take medicine every single day forever fades, but probably never totally leaves you.
Honestly, I remember after my transplant, they get you up fast. You don't get to lay around and heal. When you're up and you're off the ventilator, the next day they get you up and you're walking. Despite all of the horrible pain that I was in after my transplant, I mean, I thought the artificial heart made me feel so much better. Having this new, beautifully working heart, I mean, my face was warm, my cheeks were warm. At that moment, I knew I had my life back. I just, you know, just every little thing just meant so much more to me. Looking at myself, and I looked alive, but it was a long process, you know, just getting back into the world and just getting used to everyday life. I was so used to just being in a room and pressing a button and, you know, food was brought. But I would say probably 2 years after my transplant, I was off of prednisone and I really started to get more active and hanging out with my, you know, with my friends again and just feeling just more like a young woman.
Because we've stayed in contact, I think about your story relatively often, and I'm just amazed, one, of medical technology, but two, just the resilience of people. And you are one of the most resilient people that I've ever met. I'm so glad that you have gotten your life back and you actually were able to start a family. And so what year was it that you found out you were pregnant?
2016.
And I'm sure, you know, in the back of your mind, you wondered, well, is there any risk that my child could have this heart condition?
Right. That was my biggest fear.
And what were you told?
My original diagnosis was viral cardiomyopathy. I was told that this couldn't be passed down because it was a virus. The virus was gone. I mean, I had a different heart and there was no way that my baby could get this viral cardiomyopathy.
Did that ease your mind a bit?
It did. Yeah. It made me feel good. I still made sure to, like, I was still a high risk patient myself. So I did get a lot more ultrasounds than, you know, the normal woman who is doing a normal type of pregnancy and not high risk. But all the time, whenever I got a chance to, I just asked them to look at her heart just because it made me feel better. I always wanted to listen to her heart just because it was so strong and it was just like, it was amazing. So I did always push for that. Just let me see your heart. How's it doing? And that made me feel better. Just every time they said, it looks great. Don't worry, mama. You know, her heart is good. Her heart is good. Her heart is good. Everyone told me her heart is good.
And you gave birth and was it relatively uncomplicated?
I'm a complicated girl. Though, so
fair.
It was a little crazy. She was healthy. She was early. She was born at 31 weeks, but she was just small. She was 3 pounds, 1 ounce, no health issues, no breathing issues. She just needed to gain weight and basically learn how to eat, which is normal for a baby born at 31 weeks. I was put into a coma because I had a lot of fluid on me and I didn't wake up until 3 days after I had her. But other than that, I was okay.
Given everything that you've been through, I guess it is kind of, but other than that, wow. Wow. And so Malaya was healthy, right? And she was healthy as far as you knew. And at some point you started to know something was wrong.
Yeah. She was in the NICU for 2 months, for 8 weeks. She got to go home. She was doing great. She was eating. She was hitting her milestones, a little bit delayed just because, you know, she was in NICU for a little bit, but other than that, she was normal. She was healthy. She was a normal, cute little girl. When she was 5 months old, we noticed that there was something wrong. It was really like she was just extremely fussy. She wouldn't eat. And she was a baby who loved her bottle, loved her pacifier. And so we kind of thought it was that she was teething. One night, she just was crying. She wouldn't sleep anytime. We laid her down. She woke up. She was breathing really quickly. She just seemed very uncomfortable.
Be sure to check out part 2 to find out what happens in the second half of this story. Also, let me know your thoughts about the first episode of Lean In. I'm easy to reach. You can find me at Twitter at Jabron Pasha, on Instagram at What Medicine Did, and on UnlockingImplicitBias.com. Thanks for leaning in with me.